Thanks for joining us for this episode of New Books in Philosophy. I'm Robert Talese. I'm professor of philosophy at Vanderbilt University. I co-host the program with Carrie Figder. Carrie is associate professor of philosophy at the University of Iowa. My guest today is Brian O'Connor. Brian is professor of philosophy at University College Dublin. He works in social and political theory with special emphasis on the idiom of critical theory that emerged from the Frankfurt School of Political Philosophy and Social Science. Today, we'll be talking about Brian's latest book, which is titled Idleness, a Philosophical Essay. It's just been published with Princeton University Press. Now, culturally, idleness is widely derided as laziness, uselessness, and sloth. And even within philosophy, the idle are criticized for being wasteful and freeloaders. Indeed, throughout the history of moral and political philosophy, it's frequently asserted, but not often argued, that humans must be perpetually active, busy, and, in a word, productive. But why? Is there really nothing to be said in favor of idling? In his new book, Brian O'Connor examines a range of anti-idleness views and finds them lacking. He then proposes an alternative account of idleness, according to which it's a component of human freedom. Now, as usual, there's a lot to talk about. But also, as usual, we'll begin with our guest. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Bob.
How are you today?
Very well. Very well. Nice to talk to you.
Oh, it's great to talk to you. Why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, as you mentioned at the beginning, I work in Dublin. I'm also from Dublin, where I grew up. I did my undergraduate education at University College Dublin. Went abroad to England, to Oxford, to work on my doctoral studies. My supervisor there was Michael Rosen, he's now at Harvard. And then just as I was winding up there, a job came up at my old university. So I've been there ever since. So my story is pretty much that of a Dubliner through and through.
And you can go home, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, it's a fine place to live. And I have nothing but good memories of pretty much all of my life through to the present day living here. I grew up, Dublin's traditionally considered to be divided, at least in the past, into two halves, the north side and the south side. It's since acquired a west side, but I grew up on the north side, which was for a long time regarded as the less fashionable of the two. But it was a wonderful place to grow up. It was pretty unregulated. We had open fields. I think I got my first real taste of idleness then. And I look back on those times with fondness.
Is Dublin still, is that section of Dublin still the less fashionable section?
No, you know, with the upsurge of the economy over the last 15 to 20 years, basically anywhere that was already well settled became gentrified or re-inhabited by the well-to-do. And so there's very little of Dublin that isn't, in some sense, fashionable and over-expensive at this point.
Ah, it's the... Yeah. Living in Nashville, we are experiencing the same. Well, we have been experiencing the same kind of thing. Why don't we talk? Get to talking about the book. Does that sound like a good plan?
I hope so.
Great. So maybe let's begin with the project itself. As I was mentioning to you before we began, you know, when I saw the notice of your book, it struck me because. The only other work that I was familiar with that was devoted particularly to the topic of idleness was an old Bertrand Russell essay, which I'm sure many of our listeners might have read at some point in their life. Can you tell us a little bit about what drew you to the topic?
Yeah, I think a number of strands brought me there, but it wasn't planned. I just seemed to happen on it. But one of the strands is a pretty straightforward one. I've been interested in a long time in understanding the philosophical idea of autonomy. And given my, you know, training in the history of philosophy, particularly in German idealism, it was obvious that I would try to come to grips with Kant's texts. And right there in the groundwork, there is a rather surprising denunciation of idleness, which, you know, caught my attention and seemed to bother me more than a number of his other unusual claims.
Yeah.
And I just tried to figure it out. And then again, with the historical sort of training, I started looking around to see whether he was the only one who had a dim view of idleness. And, you know, luckily for me, all of the major critics were people working in areas of philosophy that I didn't find terribly hard to come to terms with. So the German idealists, those post-Enlightenment or, you know, concurrent with the Enlightenment thinkers, are where much of the strong criticism of a particular kind of idleness arose. So it was really just finding that passage in Kant and discovering that he wasn't alone in his condemnation that gave rise to the urge to try to understand it. But I guess there's always something, well, at least if you work in the kind of tradition, which, as you mentioned at the beginning, I do, which is the tradition of critical theory, it isn't really just about exploring points for purely historical reasons. And actually, we just mentioned the burgeoning economy in the country in which I live. And it was really quite extraordinary to see the enormous growth in productivity and wealth and busyness, everybody saying they were never busier, and a certain competitiveness at the level of busyness. I also noticed that people were making themselves rather vulnerable with all of this commitment to super productivity, because we had a rather major recession. And not only, you know, was that telling on by the usual economic indicators, but there was tremendous existential disasters for all kinds of people who not simply lost wealth, but lost purpose, lost identity. And I think that was sort of playing in the back of my mind when I wondered whether idleness hadn't been given a raw deal by the top thinkers of our philosophical practices in the West.
Yeah, so good. That both of those kinds of concerns, so the sort of surprise that the history of philosophy sort of taking oddly, you know, let me put it this way. What comes out in the book is not only that, you know, a certain strand of philosophers have come out against idleness, but they've sort of come out against idleness with an unexpected level of vehemence.
Yeah, that's very true. And it's you know, one of the things I tried to put across was that there is a kind of a historical shift in the way in which idleness is treated from the sort of the end of the 18th century onwards, in philosophical circles at least. Right across the world, wherever you have, you know, civilizations, settled cultures, there's very little tolerance of laziness. That's for sure. And the Christian tradition would be one among many that condemns idleness as such. Usually, though, there is a sense that the human being is at risk of degeneration by idleness. But something different happened among the philosophers in the era that sort of grabbed my attention, which was their emphasis wasn't so much on whether we need to avoid idleness for fear of falling into kind of degeneracy, but whether we were actually missing out on opportunities to make the very best of ourselves, something that they claimed that we had a moral duty to do. And I thought maybe to some listeners will sound strange, but actually that thought has survived into contemporary ethical thought. I mean, no less a philosopher than Christina Korsgaard makes a huge amount of play on the idea that we have a duty to make the most of ourselves, and that idleness is a constant enemy of that to the achievement of that duty. So that's a kind of a very modern idea. Nowhere in the past, I think, is the worry about idleness that it prevents a certain kind of level of self-realization. Rather, it's kind of beginning of a certain kind of moral disease. So the philosophers lead the charge in a kind of a post-religious framing of idleness.
Yeah, and you know, in the States at least, it's not uncommon. And your book helped me sort of think or notice this feature of a certain vernacular in the States. It's not uncommon for one to talk about the retired, the elderly, as people who've earned idleness.
Yeah.
Which, again, you know, after I started hearing that sort of well, they've earned it. You know, they've put in a good, you know, however many years work, and now they're enjoying this, you know, their retirement. They've earned it. And it your book helped me think, like, now that's an interesting thought, that idleness is something you need to earn.
Yeah.
Which ties idleness to the productivity ideal in a pretty explicit way, right?
Yeah, I think so. And actually, this is a really interesting thought. I suspect that when people, you know, utter that thought, they probably use the word leisure, which is a little bit more respectable than idleness, because idleness might bring to mind the image of a completely, you know, vacant, purposeless existence, whereas even those who've earned their rest, we probably have a prejudice in favor of them doing something useful with that rest. And that's what we call leisure. You know, hopefully they now have time to learn those languages they swore they would learn when they were too busy to do so, or to travel, or to, I don't know, to do more of something that they couldn't do. And that's a kind of a positive use of the time that you get when, as you say, you deserve your rest after a career of intensive productivity and effort. But idleness, I think, gives people a certain kind of disconcerting image of an utterly shapeless, risky existence. I think the phrase "well-earned leisure" is current right across our Western cultures, if not beyond. Yeah.
So great. And now maybe this is a nice segue then. So I'm sure many of our listeners now are wondering, given that we've just contrasted idleness with sort of wanton inactivity or freeloading or, as you just said, the shapeless existence. And laziness. Can you tell us a bit, maybe to get us started into the substance of the book and the argument, can you tell us what you mean by idleness? What is it? How is it different from, say, laziness?
Well, I'll start with the laziness point. I don't think it's very easy to definitively distinguish it from laziness, because in some people's usage, I think they are referring to the very same concept. But one way we might distinguish them is to think of laziness as a bit like what the old philosophers called a sort of weakness of will. So we might think a lazy person knows perfectly well what they ought to be doing, but just isn't particularly pushed to do it. So they understand their responsibilities and their duties and the importance of their career and self-development, but they just aren't really motivated. I think of the idle, in contrast, are people who don't just feel the appeal of those things in the first place, who don't recognize the significance of productivity and self-realization and making the most of one's life, or, you know, looking back on a life worth living, as some people grandly look back on their lives. So it's different in that respect. But already you can see that the way I'm coming at this is slightly negative. I'm finding it easier to say what idleness is in terms of the things that it isn't. So it is indifference, I think, to how one should make the most of oneself. It's indifference to the games of, you know, social progress, social advancement, and competition. It's a disregard for what philosophers like Rousseau thematized so brilliantly as opinion. So it's clearly not inertia in that respect. It's really a kind of inactivity with regard to specific kinds of values, as I say, like productivity, social esteem, opinion, and so forth.
So in that respect, then, is idleness on this conception also distinct from what we might think of as rest, right? Where rest, and maybe even the kind of rest that we associate with vacationing, taking time off. These are all rest, taking time off, maybe a certain sense of what the term leisure or leisure refers to. These are all terms about sort of stepping away from productive activity for the sake of returning to it more refreshed, right?
Exactly. So One way in which I try to capture that distinction is to think about leisure in that sense as kind of being incorporated within the world of work. And it really is. I mean, in well-run companies, vacation is not something that's begrudgingly given by employers to their rebellious workers. It's rather something that is regarded as good HR practice.
Yeah.
Workers who are rested come back, with fresh ideas. They come back with maybe a bit more commitment to the job and so forth. Sometimes there are even, good management reasons to give people time off, which is it's an opportunity for the boss to review the work when the actual worker isn't protecting it from review. But generally speaking, leisure is something that is part and parcel of the world of work, and not just a kind of a begrudging concession to the worker, but an important part of what makes the world of work as well as it does.
Right. And so the justification of leisure time off, as we call it in the States, we have this HR term, flex time.
Oh, yeah.
these are all justified by means of, right, their instrumental value from the perspective of the working world, right, productivity. Whereas idleness, I take it on this on the conception that you're aiming to defend, is, well, as you put it, a kind of indifference to those instrumental considerations.
Yeah, I think so. And people actually find it, I've noticed, difficult, just probably because I haven't really thought about it before, but at first find it difficult to imagine that kind of idleness. So people will hear, that there's some unusual interest among philosophers in the topic of idleness, and they say, I really like idling. And they'll give examples that actually turn out to be perfect examples of the incorporation model. That's to say, they say, I like to take the weekend off because that's when I get my best ideas or whatever. And I like to take a good walk because I come back with, much, much greater motivation to get back to my projects. But that really isn't idleness. That's kind of recuperation that is productive. Yeah.
Exactly. Great. Yeah. So good. Why don't we? So the way that the argument of the book proceeds is, as I said in the introduction, is by way of a series of engagements with anti-idleness views, we might call them.
Yeah.
And as we've also mentioned, it is pretty remarkable that there's just a sort of a kind of a throwaway line in the groundwork that oddly comes out very strongly against the idle. And it's not clear what, so there's a kind of almost sort of an animus against idleness. So I want to make sure that we get to talk a little bit about some of these historical engagements. So
right.
Can we talk a little bit, maybe you can run us through in some more detail than what you've already provided. Let's begin with Kant. Can you spell out sort of what your reconstruction of the Kantian anti-idleness picture?
Yeah, well, if the only thing Kant had ever said about idleness was that passage in the Groundwork, then really there wouldn't be, much controversy. Just to remind your listeners what he does talk about in the Groundwork, and then to refer to some of the other issues that contribute to an overall position against idleness. In the Groundwork, he imagines a group that he refers to. I'm not quite sure who he has in mind, as the South Sea Islanders, and he's read some kind of geographical report or explorer's report about how these people live rather blissfully in idleness. And it's almost so he allows the thought to slip out and then pulls it back from us as soon as he can, because he thinks that although that could function as a law of nature, after all, the South Sea Islanders do manage to preserve themselves and reproduce themselves. So they live effectively according to nature. But what we could never do is endorse a life like that as moral agents, because and that's where the argument becomes sticky, because we wouldn't see it as a way of life worthy of beings like us. And that alerts us to a kind of a prejudice in his thinking. And it turns out that there are other parts of his philosophy where there's a great deal of emphasis on the importance of effort and worthiness. It's found in particular strands. So his famous essay on universal history talks about the progress of human beings as one in which an inbuilt incapacity for rest is one which ensures that whenever we achieve anything through this restlessness, we kind of achieve something that's worthwhile. Well, let me put that a different way, that we have this, we're ill-equipped in comparison with other creatures because what we find all around us in nature simply isn't good enough for us. And this restlessness that's built into human nature is such that we want to bring order, you know, we want to go beyond the bare essentials that nature provides for us. And from that, we gain something he calls a sense of worthiness. And this worthiness is like something we ought to acquire. So with that in mind, referring back to the blissful South Sea Islanders, they live too close to nature. They make no effort to really improve their circumstances. They really, in Kant's, I guess, imaginary, do little more than just reach out and take what it is they need. But beings like us who have a different conception of what we ought to be understand that settling for what is just given to us is just not something we could ever feel elevated by. So if that's the case, then, you know, the temptations of idleness really have serious consequences. They stand in the way of human beings achieving a worthiness. And I find, and maybe it's something I will hope to continue to explore at some point, I find the notion of worthiness just that little bit obscure. It seems to do a lot of work without really being explained in non-circular terms. Mm-hmm. You know, it's both an objective and it's also a something that motivates us. And it's not clear how we acquire it and how there are civilizations that live perfectly successfully without it.
Right.
So there are those different strands to his thought that add up to quite a few, points of convergence on the question of idleness.
Yeah, and I guess that even just within the confines of the moral theory, and particularly even within the confines of the groundwork, you know, I'll confess, I've never quite understood the full motivation in Kant for the moral duty to develop one's talents or the moral duty to improve oneself. That's always seemed to me the part in the groundwork where I just, you know, I can't see the thread of the argument leading him there. But maybe that's just my own problem. But
I share that sense of perplexity.
Right. Good. So then it looks like if there is a moral duty to develop your talents, if there's something immoral about the person who could be a great surgeon but instead likes to golf, then it does look like it's not only an anti-idleness view in the sense that we're not making the most of ourselves, we're wasting something within ourselves, we're not, you know, constituting ourselves as selves, to use some Coors Guardian kinds of imagery, but we're actually living immorally, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we're at the very least, we're a disappointment to ourselves in that if we were for a moment stirred to reflect morally on what we're doing, we know we couldn't defend it. That's right. Yeah. Why we'd be stirred to make any kind of assessment of what we were doing in a kind of an idle, indeed semi-hedonistic space, why we would feel that the call of moral self-assessment is not clear either.
Yeah, that's, you know, that's an interesting piece of this as well, because we know that it's a thought that's been swimming around moral philosophy for a long time. Many people encounter it for the first time in the Susan Wolf Moral Saints essay. We just say, yeah, there are regions of human conduct where it's just it's not that we should even think of them in terms of moral permissibility or impermissibility. They're just not subject to moral evaluation in a certain respect, right?
Right.
It's just beyond the reach of morality. And maybe we need there to be sort of facets or regions within a human life that is otherwise morally accessible as good or flourishing. Maybe we just need those regions where it's morally neither here nor there. Morality just is not part of the story for that part of one's life. It's not that it's morally permissible to do what you like. It's that the categories of moral assessment are kind of misplaced.
I completely agree with that. That's really very much what I think myself, and something that I try to establish by the end of the book. Yeah, that's right. There are spaces of experience that just are, well, we can try to thematize what they are in other kinds of philosophical discussions, but what they don't seem to be are, if you like, moral kinds. They are just forms of living in a way that it just appears to be agreeable or meaningful, but yeah, lose their shape entirely if we bring sort of a moral calculus to bear on them.
Right, right. So great. Mm. So we've got this sort of brooding view in Kant. The next move that you make is to sort of a pretty natural one, I should say. To talk a little bit about the way that anti-idleness figures in Hegel and then Marx, where it is an interesting it's an interesting progression from the Kantian you have to make yourself worthy of something by developing yourself or constituting the self in particular ways. To these two subsequent sort of German thinkers who in some ways stand opposed to Kant or see themselves as standing opposed to Kant, but in lots of crucial junctures wind up just reformulating some right. Kantian themes. So can you tell us a bit about how the Hegel Marx sort of post-Kantian trajectory treats idleness?
Well, I think Hegel is a really challenging critic of idleness, whereas Kant, explores the notion of idleness through a thought experiment and wonders whether the lives of others, exotic others, are defensible in the moral terms that we make our own. Hegel just thinks that question is already mistaken. You know, that can't really be a question for people like us. And in a sense, it's slightly maddening, because the reason why it can't be a question for us is because we are not conditioned to be idlers. We're already socialized by our practical education, by the norms we internalize about making ourselves useful. So to ask oneself, should I be idle, is just a nonsensical question from the embedded perspective, which is what we all have as readers of Hegel, in the embedded perspective of, properly socialized members of our advanced industrious civilizations. So, he has nothing but scorn where he refers to idleness at all, because it's always a kind of a grotesque alternative to what we do. It's an alternative that just falls so far below what it is that we basically are. It's inappropriate for us. He offers the image of a barbarian, and again, we don't really know what culture or location this barbarian is to be found in. But the barbarian is virtually the opposite of everything we think of ourselves as being. The barbarian is solitary for some reason. He's lazy. He's brooding, at least that's the way the main English translation captures it. So he contrasts effectively the characteristics of the idle barbarian with the kind of gregarious switched on Westerner who's always kind of looking for something to do. Yeah, that's right. And he also has a kind of a historical debate with Diogenes, who I think some ground is made to give Hegel some credit against Diogenes, because Diogenes is kind of a performative idler, right. and Hegel finds that reprehensible. In a sense, it's a contrivance, as it must be, because in the end, it goes back to the point that, you know, Diogenes, no matter how spectacular his efforts to shock his contemporaries will be, is in the end a socialized Athenian trying to shock right. his contemporaries. Yeah. So, in other words, Hegel really, what's so challenging about his position is that he tries to kind of undermine the very idea of idleness as a thought that we can, you know, defensively have, given where we stand.
Yeah, so that's interesting. And how does that get spelled out then, or carried forward in a more materialist idiom, we might say, from the Hegelian in Marx?
Yeah, I think my reading of Marx wouldn't be everyone's. I concentrate mainly on the early Marx, right. where it seems to me that he emphasizes a kind of an effective relationship between members of a community. And he has a very positive notion of work when he refers to it as social work, in that it's always a contribution to the knowing needs of others. If you go back to Hegel, Hegel has some interest in the classical economists, that's to say Smith and his followers, and understands that the way in which we work in the system of needs, as he calls it, is not always with any kind of conscious concern for the well-being of others, but we're kind of shaped to contribute to that. Marx, at least in the earlier phase, seems to have a more conscious, or assert that there could be a more conscious concern for the needs of others in a kind of a communal space when we undertake work. So in that respect, I mean, it's very obvious why idleness would be a bad thing. It's basically selfishness. It's a refusal to give a damn about the needs of others. It's a refusal to play one's part in what could be a complex and organic system of mutual satisfaction.
Yeah. So let's turn to one issue that you say you think is where the action is at for the idleness versus the anti-idleness. And this comes up in a discussion of Schopenhauer, among others, which is the worry that idleness, even construed in the way that you are understanding it, not as laziness, not as leisure, but as just a sort of stepping back from an indifference towards the world of producing. The worry is that idleness is destined to bore us, or to create boredom in us. And yeah. The argument then, I guess, you know, it's easy to spell out, like, well, boredom is obviously a bad thing. So if idleness is destined to produce boredom, idleness looks like it's going to be inherit that badness. Can you tell us a bit about your views about idleness and the response to the worry about boredom?
Yeah, I think at the superficial level, the claim that idleness leads to boredom is actually well made. I think that's a genuine experience. Just by coincidence today, I heard some report that a lot of workers, in spite of their entitlements, are not taking up their full complement of annual leave. And, you know, there are different reasons for that. Sometimes it's simply that they don't have the extra income to enjoy a nice vacation. One of the reasons is that they actually find increasingly people are finding the image of or the experience of a long vacation actually quite tedious, and there's a kind of a longing to get back to the desk or back to the driving seat or whatever one's role is. And this can only be because work has become such a presence in the daily structure of their lives that the time spent not working is actually a challenge. It's something that we're not really well trained to do. So I think, again, at the superficial level, the connection between boredom and idleness is a very real one. The difficulty about the way in which Schopenhauer makes the claim, though, is that he considers it to be just a fact of nature.
Right.
You know, it's in the essence of human beings that when idle, this horrific experience of boredom will overcome them. He has a complicated enough kind of psychology, a philosophical psychology, in which he thinks of human beings as endlessly willing. When the will is not attached to any particular project, it keeps whirling around and sort of tormenting itself. And that's what he thinks of as the experience of boredom. It's an unsettling, disturbing experience, and human beings will do anything to avoid it. So really the argument with Schopenhauer is whether his psychology is based on nature or whether, in fact, he has mistakenly taken the conditioning of workers, or particularly those of his own sort of social set, to be natural, when in fact they're the product of highly educated, highly competitive and ambitious individuals who will see idleness, who will see having no major project to do as a kind of a crushing lack in their lives. So that's really the major argument I have with Schopenhauer. But you know, there are a fair number of psychological studies about boredom that are connected with idleness, and generally speaking, those studies find idleness and boredom to be entwined in a fairly self-destructive relationship. Even some of the major psychiatric disorders have occasionally been diagnosed as having self-destructive tendencies produced by boredom. You know, people will do the most dangerous things sometimes just to get a kind of a thrill or to excite themselves. So idleness is in those cases something that people just can't manage. And I've been known to kind of, as it were, expunge that idleness by undertaking dangerous, self-destructive or unhealthy actions. Yeah, so I mean, Schopenhauer, like Kant, like Hegel, and indeed like Marx, they're all there in the study because I think they have something really important to say. It's just I think that they haven't quite got at the phenomenon correctly. You know, they're not sort of lined up as a series of kind of sitting ducks to allow readers to be impressed by my marksmanship. It's that they really have a kind of a model for work and experience that says something that many readers will recognize from their own sort of daily explanations to themselves of why they work, or why they think work is something worth doing, or what is the consequences of work of not working might be. And the boredom thesis is certainly one I think is one that many people will relate to without ever having a word of Schopenhauer.
And I take it that your quarrel with particularly with the Schopenhauerian line is just that there's no reason to attribute this drive for busyness and productivity to anything that's natural about human beings. It's just the social world is set up from the time that we're very young to create within us a system of desires and other psychological mechanisms that drive us to locate our worth and locate worthiness of any of our activities with production.
Exactly. And I know it's always a risky path to go down the sort of the route of the ad hominem kind of analysis, but we know that Schopenhauer himself was a highly driven individual who, at least that's what the biographies report,
right.
A highly driven individual who was really quite obsessed with his own fame, with his own advancing reputation in the German world of letters. So we have to assume that he would not have found rest that easy. He generalized from his own experiences growing up in a kind of an ambitious household that this was just the way human beings were designed. On the boredom issue, there's another dimension that I thought was worth exploring, though. I found a fascinating discussion in Simone de Beauvoir's work,
right,
about the image of the idle woman. And it's a fascinating critique, because some rather traditionally minded philosophers, and there's a very controversial passage in Kierkegaard to this effect, have imagined that women of a certain class kind of excel in the art of idleness. But Beauvoir sort of blows a hole in that whole myth by describing the kind of social pressures that might lead women of a certain time and a certain class to look like they're idle, to look like they're the ideal sort of complement to the busy, thrusting partner that they have as a husband. And I found that probably one of the most challenging scenarios for trying to find more positive accounts of idleness, because her account of the idle woman was really quite distressing. It's the image of a woman who, in order to be the kind of, almost unthreatening companion to a husband, abandons any kind of effort she might once have made to educate herself or to acquire skills. All of this seems to have no major implications during the early years of marriage, where there are perhaps are children to keep them all occupied. But once the woman finds herself without those kinds of distractions, she has no skills, she has no proper education, and the idleness then becomes a burden. She doesn't know how to fill the time. So I thought that image of the idle woman was really quite a challenge to those who, like myself, would want to find a better account of experience than that of constant productivity. But again, the answer to a position like Beauvoir, or let's put it this way, the insight one can gain from reading someone like Beauvoir, is that the institution of marriage as designed in the one that she is considering is one where idleness is almost an implicitly enforced norm.
Right.
And it certainly underpins the reality that individuals who don't know how to use their idle time will find it a struggle. But when it's enforced, the book that Beauvoir writes talks about, the kind of women she's talking about are women who have had the experience of education, the experience of thinking about what they might do, but then who somehow bring that to an unnatural halt. So they're not really idlers in the proper sense. It's a kind of an enforced, a sort of a stunted self-development.
Right. So this is a nice segue into the sort of more positive account that you develop in the latter chapters of the book. So you find some inspiration in an account of play that we find articulated in Marcuse and Schiller. Mm-hmm. Can you make the connection then between that conception of playfulness and the view of idleness that you eventually wind up articulating in the concluding chapter?
Yeah, the discussion of Schiller on play is more technical, certainly, than the discussion of Marcuse. And that's because Schiller arrives at a notion of play through his conception, if you like, of the legacy of Kantian philosophy. And that is to say, Kant's philosophy says really there are two kinds of compulsion or necessities. One is the necessity that's brought about by moral duty. And even Kant concedes that sometimes that's rather unpleasant. You know, doing what one knows one ought to do might be morally fulfilling, but it's not always pleasant. And then there's the compulsion of pleasure, the necessity of pleasure, of just following one's desires, that effectively is the path of immorality. Schiller speculates that there might be some way of conjoining those two necessities, where you have the kind of idea of freedom that is involved in moral freedom, but you have the kind of pleasurableness that's involved in following one's desires. And he models that under the notion of freedom, of play. Now, as you'd expect, a theory as ambitious as that is going to struggle, you know, just synthesizing two strands and thinking you can produce a coherent third. It fails in pretty much every philosophical case where that's attempted. But at the same time, there's a kind of an attractive image in that it seems to detach freedom from the more gruesome notions of self-realization and the achievement of worthiness that Schiller himself found in Kant. The Marcuse discussion is, although it starts with a kind of acknowledgement of Schiller's contribution, is really kind of a reflection on Marx and an attempt to take Marx's image beyond, mm-hmm. The negative associations many would have with it, which in the end, as I think Adorno once said, Marx just wanted to turn the world into a great big workhouse.
Yeah.
How can we think of work as something that might be pleasurable? How would work be something that doesn't, if you like, violate our sensuousness, where it doesn't compel us to kind of distort our experiences into the working day and separate it entirely from spheres of pleasure? It's clear from what I'm saying that a discussion like that is going to push us in a kind of a utopian direction, because where work would be something a bit more like play and a bit more like idleness, it's not clear it really means anything anymore. But, I think the effort is significant, because those two philosophers, Schiller and Marcuse, are among the few who recognize the kind of threat that's inherent in the very modern idea that the self, just as much as anything else, is a space of work, that it must be crafted in order to become a kind of an effective object in the world. There's a sense in which the notion of playfulness loosens that kind of obligation.
Right. So then the big question now is, so what's the positive? So the positive upshot is, I guess, first, that the sort of the standard fare of anti-idleness views in philosophy, they're not as powerful, or the arguments aren't as cogent as we might be led to think by the people who proffer them. And also, though, that you want to claim that idleness has that there's a component of or a kind of human freedom that is inaccessible to us unless we understand the value of idleness. Can you tell us about?
Sure.
Yeah,
that's absolutely right. Again, it seems to me that people have an image of idleness oftentimes. Not everyone, of course. I mean, whatever people might think, in my experience, people working as professors in universities have an incredible work ethic, and many of them have said to me they don't even recognize anything attractive about idleness as I describe it. But there are some who, like myself, will confess to that vice, and I try to figure out, well, what is it that is in idleness that seems so appealing? And I think many people will say, I like the idea of not being driven by the imperatives of productivity and of esteem and all those things we've mentioned before. So how do we capture that? It represents to me a kind of image of freedom. It's very different from the major models of freedom that we find in the classical theories of freedom in social philosophy, because it has nothing to do with freedom in the context of others as such, which is the major Hegelian model. It simply recognizes itself as valuable to itself because it is not, as it were, under the constraints or the direction of purposes that lie outside oneself. So I think that's the sense in which idleness can be defended as a form of freedom. It's action which is not reducible to the command of others or of institutions. It has a kind of it has its own sense of what it is it wants to do without instruction from those sources.
That's interesting. Is it possible to fail at idleness?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think that one of the difficulties I have when I try to answer a tricky question like that.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, is that I'm not sure how far I can go in imagining a positive sort of state of idleness, such that then I could also say, well, this is somebody trying positively to be idleness and failing at it. I think for those of us who are socialized and great workers and so on, I think we probably find we fail at idleness much of the time. I mean, I guess there are numerous instances where we think we might take a break, or we might think we do something that's very different from work, and our minds are pulled back in various ways. I mean, it's clearly not helped by the information technology we have these days, where you're never really away from anything anyway.
Yeah.
But you know, I think we know that leisure isn't what it used to be. Even leisure, that period of recuperation that's sanctioned, if you like, by the regime of work, even leisure isn't what it used to be when people are checking emails or receiving communications that, you know, in a sense, play on their minds as they're supposedly away from the places of work.
Yeah.
Is there a
one thought too many style problem sort of looming in the endeavor to initiate a period of idleness? Does it look like it's a fact? So surely the sort of negative way of understanding the phenomenon is winning, right? That our lives have been sort of colonized by all of these concepts and drives and norms associated with work and production and cooperation aimed at some jointly produced end. Idleness is the indifference to, the stepping back from, perhaps in some sense, the rejection of that. But there's a worry about the whether idleness can be the object of one's intentional. I can't try to be surprised.
right.
It's like, does idleness have that sort of feature to it, that it can't be, you know, okay, on Sundays is be idle.
Exactly. Because I mean, if what I say in the book is in any way correct, then, you know, that switching to idleness would involve some kind of supreme act of, you know, schizophrenic, selfhood, because you would be one day this and the other day, you know, not. And I don't get into the book, and I think, you know, sometimes I my feeling is that people might be a bit frustrated that I don't, into making any positive recommendations and saying, well, look, idleness is good for you, and all you really need to think about in order to be idle are the following. I think what I contribute is a little bit further below the surface than that, which is to say, well, if you sometimes wonder why it is that you can't act on the idleness you sometimes imagine you'd like to act on, maybe it's one or more of the following beliefs that affect your capacity to act on that idleness. And as it happens, those beliefs are not just your beliefs. These are beliefs that run quite deeply in our culture, so much so that they have managed to make an impact on a number of important philosophical texts. The philosophers obviously take them to a grander level where they, you know, capture these intuitions about why we shouldn't be idle and place them in their big systems of social theory and so forth. But in the end, they're really closely related to the everyday views that, you know, there's something kind of unworthy about being idle, or there's something selfish, or something impossible about being idle, or boring about being idle, and so on. And so, as I say, when people ask themselves, well, why is it that I think I'd like to idle, but I find myself inclined against it? I think some of the analysis of the book, you know, might excavate some of that. Now, I don't believe that any one of us brought up as we are and socialized really could be idle as such, but at least we might wonder why it is that we are, it seems, in two minds about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let me just say, the book is fabulous. I had a great time reading it, and highly recommend it to everybody who has been, well, all of my colleagues, anybody who's been asked me a philosophical question. I've said, by the way, there's this Brian O'Connor book that I really think everyone should be reading. So, Brian, you've been very generous with your time. I know it's a, as I say often at the end of these interviews, you know, it's a cruel question to ask somebody who's just written a fabulous book what they're going to do next. And I think there's an additional irony to this final question, given the topic of your book. What are you going to do next?
Well, it's just as well. I said a few moments ago that I don't have any positive recommendations to those who might look to me to tell them how to be idle, because I struggle with it myself. And so I'd be involved in a performative self-contradiction because I am quite busy. I do want to get more deeply into the question of autonomy. I also hope to put together a sort of a volume on the history of perceptions of work, because in a way that work is the other side of the question of idleness. So, yeah, I've got quite a bit going on, and all of my fantasies of idleness are constantly challenged by the projects that seem to suggest themselves to me for one reason or another.
Well, I look forward to seeing more on related topics to the one you've just written this fantastic book about. I want to close by thanking you for your time today, Brian.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you.
And it's been fabulous to talk to you. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for our discussion. I remind you, the book is written by Brian O'Connor. His new book is titled Idleness, A Philosophical Essay, and it's been published by Princeton University Press. Thanks for tuning in. Bye for now.